He's a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and has studied gun violence, both its causes and prevention, for more than 20 years, and is one of the leading thinkers about evaluating the effects of laws, including permit-to-purchase licensing laws. So thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Jan. It's actually very convenient, the order of our talks, because some of this will be, I won't have to cover some of the legal ground. Again, nothing to disclose on my part here, so we'll move into the substance of the talk. So Jan covered the sort of legal issues around licensing gun dealers. What I want to talk you through briefly is, what does that actually feel like? What do you actually do when you go in to purchase a gun under a different legal regimes, if you will? So in most states, it's a really pretty easy and simple process. You go into the gun shop, you pick out whatever gun you're interested in, you present an ID and complete a form. Usually the background check process will be minutes, and you pay and you walk out the door, sometimes maybe with multiple guns. Sometimes it might be assault weapons, variety of different things you could walk out with. And importantly, this whole process is vetted by gun dealers, federally licensed gun dealers that Jan was referring to. And the gentleman in this, in the nice plaid shirt here is Sandy Abrams, who used to operate a shop just outside of Baltimore City, Valley Gun Shop. The ATF and federal prosecutors referred to Sandy as a serial violator of federal firearms laws. It took them nearly a decade to shut his shop down. When his shop was shut down, Mama Abrams, his mother, 80-some-year-old mother, opened a shop next door called Just Guns. That's in the other corner there. So anyway, it's gentlemen, not, of course, there are a lot of good, upstanding gun dealers, but you may encounter a Mr. Abrams or someone of his ilk when you go in and make that easy transaction. Here are a few other individuals I'll introduce you to. On the far left is Julius Burton. He's 18-year-old. He went into Badger Guns, which is a shop just outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it had ranked number one in the nation of guns sold, later recovered in crime, for a good number of years. So Julius Burton went in there with, he had his sights set on a Taurus 40 caliber handgun, and he brought with him 21-year-old Jacob Collins, and he told Jacob, "That's the one I want." So the gentleman underneath there is the gun dealer, Adam Allen. Yes, that's his name. So the gun purchased in this situation was used to shoot and permanently disable two Milwaukee police officers who are now suing Badger Guns. So the process looked different in several states where there are permit-to-purchase licensing laws. So this is what it looks like. You decide you want to purchase a gun. The first thing you're going to need to do in many states is you're going to go to your local police or sheriff's department, and you're going to bring with you a government-issued ID, fill out an application. And in five states, they're going to fingerprint you as well. And they will initiate the background check. This is not a quick and easy process. It can take days or weeks in some circumstances, and there may be additional requirements. In many cases, there are safety training requirements and some type of certification. In a few states, they can actually deny a permit to purchase, even if you don't meet a specific disqualifying condition, but it may be other things in your background. Maybe you have a string of arrests but no convictions, for example. And importantly, in these states, permits to purchase are required for all transactions, whether it's from a licensed dealer or not. So first of all, you're going to deal with the gentleman with the badge there before you go to a licensed dealer. Jan alluded to this study. I just want to give a little bit of background. We've looked at the effects of a variety of state gun sales laws and their impact on the diversion of guns to criminals and trafficking. And as John mentioned, we saw strong gun dealer regulation and audit inspections were a big deterrent for intrastate diversions. Importantly, we also found a similarly strong effect for discretionary permit to purchase systems, as well as regulating private handgun sales. Most commonly, when private handgun sales are regulated, it is typically through this permit to purchase process. We also, very recently, in the book that we published in January of this year, there's a chapter in there where we look at gun trace data and the exportation of guns sold in one state and used in crime in another state, and looked at the relationship between the export rate and state gun laws. And we again found the permit to purchase licensing to be a very strong, effective deterrent to exporting crime guns, as well as also found that to be the case for private background checks. So I'm going to finish up talking about a very important study that we've just completed, where Missouri had a permit to purchase licensing system for handgun purchasers that it decided as of August 28, 2007, to repeal. So prior to this repeal, you had to apply for a purchase to a local sheriff's office, rather than just go to the person who's going to profit from the sale. We first looked at this. Jan mentioned this short time to crime issue, which commonly is something that you look at when you look at trafficking indicators. And I know the on the bottom axis the year is going to be hard to see late there. But basically, what we find in these indicators is a very strong correlation between the repeal of the permit to purchase and the interval between when a gun was sold and later recovered from a criminal or a crime scene. And roughly, we saw a doubling in the diversion of these very short sale-to-crime guns. We also found that, coincident with the repeal of this law, that the percentage of guns that had been sold within the state and later recovered in crimes jump quite dramatically. And this is an indicator that if you look across a number of states, is incredibly constant and stable. And you see right there a very sudden and fairly strong increase. Again, consistent with the idea that this permit to purchase law was preventing diversions of guns and exporting of guns to criminals. So the next thing we did, and most recent thing we did that we haven't published yet, is we looked at the rate of gun homicide in Missouri compared to nearby states and the rest of the country. And the yellow line there is Missouri, and you can see, coincident with the change in with the repeal of this law, an abrupt increase in gun homicide rates. Roughly, there's a 25% increase for the years 2008 through 2010, the most recent year of vital statistics data available. During the same time period, overall nationally, there was actually a downturn of about 5% in this measure of gun violence, and similarly, a downturn in Midwestern states as well. There are actually 8 states that border Missouri. No other state has more, I found out. Fun fact. So we did some of our analysis comparing changes in Missouri to the border states. So on the far left, you see Missouri and its change in age-adjusted firearm homicide rates. These are just rates for firearm homicides. And not much change going on in the other states that border Missouri. Nebraska is the one that sort of stands out there, but that was not a statistically significant change that occurred. We're also interested to know if this increase that we're observing statewide in Missouri is due to some statewide event. You would expect there to be some consistency across different local jurisdictions rather than, you know, Missouri's rate increased by 70%, but everybody else was flat. That would suggest that something weird's going on in St. Louis, and there's no really statewide story to it. But what we found is when you looked at the three main counties or jurisdictions, urban jurisdictions, as well as the next category of urbanicity, that what so-called fringe metro, in each case, you saw a 27% increase or more across these jurisdictions in fairly a fair degree of consistency. So we next did a more formal assessment using regression analysis to estimate policy effects. We looked at the study period 1999 through 2010, and we looked at 43 states. First of all, why that time period and why 43 states? Very briefly, the time period, there was a very rapid increase in firearm homicide rates in from the mid-80s through the early 1990s, and subsequently a very rapid decline. And this was not a phenomenon that was consistent across states, nor was it due to factors that most people believe are easily measurable, like unemployment or some other indicator like that. And we have a whole host of studies looking at right-to-carry laws of how all the pitfalls of comparing states' trends during that time period. The time period 1999 to 2010 has been a relatively stable period for most states. So it's a perfect, in some ways, for an interrupted time series analysis. The 43 states, CDC suppresses the data for if there are too few observations in a given year or state. So there were 43 states. If you're curious, the seven states that were dropped, all were states, understandably, with very few gun homicides. They were like Hawaii and New Hampshire. None of them were anywhere near Missouri, and Missouri's rates for gun homicide were 4 to 5 times higher than any of them. So not particularly good comparison states that were lost in this. So we looked at the effect of the law. We controlled for unemployment, poverty, burglary rate as a general measure of crime, the number of police officers per capita, incarceration rates, stand your ground laws, which was probably the biggest policy change going on during that time period of our study, as well as state and year fixed effects in the models. We adjusted our standard error for the clustering of the by state and heteroscedasticity. Yeah, I got that out. So here's the bottom line. So when we looked at, and of course we hypothesized that the effect would only be observed for firearm-related homicides and not for those committed with other types of weapons. So what we found is a very strong increase. When we first look at all covariates except stand your ground laws, we see a 29% increase associated with the repeal. When you control for stand your ground, it's 27%, still very highly significant. There were no, the coefficient was essentially zero for the non-firearm homicide rate, so no change going on there. I'll just end with mentioning that I think that the main policies that under examination here, a permit to purchase license, and then even the idea of regulating all, including private transactions, are things that should be very, basically there's a lot of public support, even among gun owners, as these data show, that 84% of gun owners support background checks in all gun sales. 6 out of 10 gun owners support permit to purchase licensing laws from getting your permit from local law enforcement. And they seem to be okay with extending the time for background checks in order to do a proper vetting of these. So just conclude, this repeal led to a sharp increase, and effects were not due to the economy or stand your ground or to local conditions. The effects seem to be just specific to firearms, and there's broad support for moving forward with this policy.